Thanks to Anna Cohen and the Cambridge Mental Wealth Group, I have the honour of saying a few words on today's speaker, Roland Littlewood, who is going to lecture on international aspects of the stigmatisation of mental illness. He graduated with a PhD in social anthropology from Oxford and is currently Professor of Anthropology and Psychiatry at UCL, as well as a consultant psychiatrist, joint founder of Nasihat Intercultural Therapy Centre North London, and past president of the Royal Anthropological Institute. He has received the Welcome Medal for work with a new religion in the Caribbean, has conducted fieldwork in Trinidad, Haiti, Lebanon, Italy, and currently in Albania, and he has written a total of 7 books and 200 papers.
200.
And as he put it in an email to me, that's right. Quite enough as an introduction. So
thank you so much. Well, doctors publish more than anthropologists do, so. Except that I've been asked to talk about stigmatisation of mental illness. The word stigma in Western usage has moved through different meanings. So briefly, a little bit on the etymology of it. Originally, a Greek word which described marks on the bodies of slaves, normally slaves who'd escaped, and said it could be recognised again when recaptured or had another master. Then it moved into the theological area, meaning the stigmata of the crucifixion. So the marks sustained by Jesus at the crucifixion, the wounds in the side, the nails in the hands and so on. Certain people miraculously acquired, starting with St. Francis in the 12th century. I'm not talking about that, although I have done work on stigmatics in Calabria in southern Italy. The more recent usage of the term, the one we're interested in today, I think, is what Goffman, who's the American sociologist who wrote the standard book on stigma, it's just called Stigma, called Discredited Identity. And so it's now a term used in general sociology. So stigmatization could apply to physical disability, say developmental things, like Tourette syndrome or other tics, to mental health issues, or to obviously overt physical things like a limp, some sort of physical distortion, speech defect, a stroke, and so on. It can also apply to certain illnesses, particularly skin diseases like leprosy, and children often stigmatize each other at school for that. If you think of the character Spotty in the Bash Street Kids, if any of you read the Beano, the character is then identified just by having spots, okay? And is ridiculed for that. Stigmatization can also be related to illnesses which are known, such as the news comes out, such as HIV and psychiatric illness in general. Stigma also related to people's aging. But also more social form of stigma related to your accent, your gait or your posture, to your skin colour, particularly on racial stigmatisation, even such things as dress, hairdressing and nudity. An example of that is my original field of work was with a nude cult in Trinidad. So I spent a year naked with this religious group. Years later I did field work in Albania where the customs are a lot different. After I'd been in my village in the Northern Mountains for about 2 weeks, I was feeling a bit sticky. So I said to them, can I have a bath in my rather bad Albanian? And they were all surprised and they said, how often do you have a bath in England? And I said, well, once a day. They were all shocked at the frivolousness of that. Anyway, eventually they produced a tin tub and put it in their garden in full view of the village and said, well, there's your bath. Now, I took all my clothes off and jumped in the bath to shrieks of horror. The nudity is totally prohibited in Albania. So the old lady with whom I was boarding screamed and ran into the house, almost vomiting. Her son turned pale and so on. Even when you have sex in Albania, you do it in the dark and you don't take your clothes off. Okay, well, after that, they assembled the bath in the stable, so I always had it next to the horse in the dark. When I came to leave the field site, I said to my informants, well, I'm sure I made many mistakes when I was with you. What's the worst thing I did? And he said, well, without a question, it's when you took your clothes off in the full view of the village. Actually, I was thin in those days, so it wasn't quite as disgusting. as one might assume. Okay, come stigmatized for your particular religion, for your sexual identity, for your caste or for your class. I've got the consciousness of Jada, who's doing research with Harry Jan, Untouchables, Dalits in India, as to how they're stigmatized by the non-untouchable population. Now, obviously, all this depends on particular context, not just on general culture, but on the microculture. Years ago, when I was working at Guy's Hospital, I had a patient, and I had got talking to the patient's brother, who's part of a South London criminal family. And we were just generally chatting. He told me about the time he'd been sent to prison for a fairly substantial period of about 4 or 5 years for criminal activity, for drug dealing, beating people up, and various other unseemly things. Now, after 6 months in Brixton, he got totally bored. And the chaplain then suggested, why didn't he pop along to the library and see if there's anything interesting to keep him amused there. So the chaplain directed him to Dickens, so he started off with Dickens, then moved on to Trollope and Thackeray, ended up with George Eliot, Hardy, and so on. Now, when he came, I know he started an open university degree at the same time. When he came out of prison, he had a problem. He still wanted to continue with his studies, more given a petty criminality. But to get his books, he had to walk through his old criminal neighbourhood in Lambeth to get to the public library. He was so ashamed of his interest in books that he had to take a circuitous route so nobody in the local community could identify him. Because in his own particular micro-community, anything to do with books was highly stigmatised. That's a somewhat facetious example. In stigmatization, we normally make a distinction between the real disability, that's your physical incapability of doing certain actions, your need for a wheelchair and so on, and your presumed disability. So whether HIV, when it first appeared in the 1980s, could be transmitted by handshake, the early scientific report said HIV is only transmitted by exchange of bodily fluids. At that time, I was working on a ward where we had a certain amount of HIV patients who at that time were often commonly had psychiatric disorders. Still happens now, but normally AIDS is halted in the Western countries before it reaches that stage. It can cause brain deterioration. I remember on my ward we made the big thing about shaking hands with the patients and taking the blood samples without gloves and so on, just to show that there was no stigmatization. Stigmatization is normally related to chronic problems. It's because of this, probably schizophrenia is more likely to be stigmatized than bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness, which on the whole you have make a spontaneous recovery and get better in between episodes. Schizophrenia being a generally continuous condition which you constantly deteriorate is much more heavily stigmatized, even though a manic patient, when the psychotic is just as crazy as somebody with schizophrenia. One of the things Erwin Goffer was interested in was what he called parsing, how you deal with a particular stigma. And one of the ways of dealing with it is just never to talk about it if it's something that's not particularly evident. When I used to have a psychiatric ward in a hospital, I had a weekly group for the patients in which we discussed social issues. And one of the things that came up was how you pass. So imagine you go on to the pub and you order half a pint of beer and somebody comes up and says, Joe, I haven't seen you for 6 months. Where have you been? You've been away. Do you tell them you've been in the loony bin or do you tell them you've been in prison, which is easiest to say? And I always say, I argued for the patients to say they'd been in prison, as in that particular media, working class media in London, that's far less stigmatizing than mental illness. But basically, I said, if possible, keep silent about it. And we just have many lots of arguments about this, and you might feel that actually you should be have a more in-your-face position, say, I've been mentally ill, so what? And that's the second option. Just in relation to taking a less stigmatizing condition, some odd work comes from New York about how mentally handicapped people deal with stigmatization, mental handicap, when they're begging or whatever in the streets. New York being New York, it's better to say you've been mentally ill, or to disguise your mental handicap as some sort of neurotic condition. And that's actually what these mentally handicapped people did. Okay, I mentioned the second possibility of brazening it out or sort of up yours. Okay, I'm both bipolar, what's your fucking problem, sort of thing. Or redefining a particular problem in some way. I forgot what I was going to say there, something about redefinition. Oh, so redefinition is a term in social sciences, really comes out of ethnic redefinition. We take a previously stigmatized identity and present it as a powerful and positive feature. So you re-inscribe and recover words like black and so on, which are previously abusive if you're a black person, and so you use it, you affirm it positively. That's in the case of ethnic redefinition, and other sorts of seem we can do the same thing. The way coping is what we call latent gain. Commonly, some of my patients who have schizophrenia or less serious psychiatric illnesses would say when I'm talking with them, well, actually, it's helped me become more sensitive to other people. When I had a particular mental health problem myself, always the world wasn't quite as confident and quite easy as it might seem to have been. It made me a much more sensitive person. Whether they actually are more sensitive or not, I actually doubt, but suddenly that becomes a rationale of having had the illness. Patients often seek support either in solidarity with other sufferers from the same condition, often as part of a self-help group, tell each other atrocity stories about how the wider society has treated them very badly, or other forms of curious social interaction. Goffman's very interested in what he called the token. He found certain making gangs, we should have a token cripple. And that use a cripple in the gang fighting to deal with the other gang's cripple. Sounds very bizarre. That involves a certain amount of reinterpretation and revalidation of the redefinition sort. Goffman tells the story of a white guy who's attached to a black gang in the 1950s. In the southern United States. He goes around with his black kids, goes swimming with them, steals bicycles with them, and so on. Now, one of the problems he has with this black gang is they often use the word nigger to each other, okay? In not in an abusive way, and in a sort of affectionate way. So he describes one, but he's unable to do this because he's white, and he just has so much baggage around it. He describes one day going swimming with these black kids and they pretend to drown him. So he comes up spluttering in the water and accuses them of being a bloody nigger. And from that time, his relationship with the whole black community totally changes. He's a lot more likely to be accepted by them. Something similar happened with me when I was doing my first field work in Port of Spain in Trinidad, although I didn't take it to quite the ambitious extent to which the guy in Goffin's story does. I was loosely attached to a Carmelite convent in Port of Spain, the capital, where my wife was doing some voluntary work for the nuns, and I took along for my field work our young daughter, who was then about 6 months old. I was keen to get away from Port of Spain altogether and get back to the village while I was doing my basic work, and my wife didn't have so much time to spend with the child because of having to work in the convent, and which had the sort of social service, old people's care thing attached to it. So we found a sort of daycare centre in another convent, also in Port of Spain, run by the same order of nuns. But both these convents in the working class, the rather rough area of Port of Spain, by East Dry River, if you know Port of Spain, towards Laventil. So every day, we were totally surrounded by people, members who were Rastafarians. So I remember sitting out with the nuns in the garden having coffee after dinner, and the huge waves of ganja smoke would come over the wall. Okay, so we took the little girl in the pushchair up to the other convent for daycare, and we had to progress through the high Rastafarian area. So the Rastas are sitting with their dreadlocks on the street, on the steps of their houses, out in cafes and so on, and they generally abuse us. We're the only whites in that area. This is a black working class area of Port of Spain. So these guys sing out as we pass by, "Hi, hi, whitey. Hi, honky baby, where are you going to today?" and so on. Suggests a certain amount of antagonism to us, also a certain amount of good humour, ridicule, but also jealousy of the fact that we could afford the day centre for this baby. Now, I really had enough of it one day. I said to them, not quite as the guy in the coffin story says, "I'm sick of being called honky. How would you like it if I called you nigger?" It's not quite the same as saying to them nigger. And the total relationship totally changed between us all. They became very good friends of mine and some of my key informants later on. Okay, I'll just end this bit of the talk with three other points. The stigmatized can themselves stigmatize. You don't become a better person by being stigmatized yourself. I remember a rather neurotic lady who had ME managing encephalomyelitis, and she admitted to my ward at the University College Hospital. And she came up to me to complain one day and said, "I know I've got mental health problems, but I can't stand this ward. It's all full of lunatics and madmen and no good black people. I don't want to be here at all. Can't you give me something better?" So she stigmatized other people's mental health problems, even though she had mental health problems herself. Sorry, it doesn't relate you off it. Another point is, where is stigma actually located? Is it in the terms we use? We're aware that terms like idiot and imbecile, used as technical terms by medicine in the 19th century, have gradually passed through mental retardation, learning disability, to end in more socially appropriate terms, such as... it's ended up as learning disability, along going through mental retardation, mental handicap, which I must say is a term I still use myself, to something more innocuous. And you were in London about 10 years ago, my member of the adversaries used to be on the tube. It was the photograph of a boy with Down syndrome. And there are three statements underneath. It says, "You call him a mongrel. Doctors call it Down syndrome. His mates call him Dave." In other words, attempt to humanize what was previously a so-called objective condition. Now, these constant changes in names, certainly the area of mental handicap, always having to change the name. I still use this rather old-fashioned term, mental handicap, and my colleagues in that sort of their Protestant term, I should be using the word learning disability, which I find quite vacuous and essentially meaningless. But do change in name actually help destigmatize? In other words, should we apply something like so-called political correctness to the issue? Should we be aware of the terms we always use? And these days, the general tendency to use in terms that don't identify the person as being an ex, so such as a schizophrenic, and we're a lot more likely these days to say somebody with schizophrenia or somebody with mental health problems. But the nurses I work with, well, I prefer the term issues, which again I find totally vacuous and rather absurd. So we have a new patient at our clinic, I say, "What's the problem?" And they say, "Well, she's got issues with drinking." I mean, for me that really means nothing at all. But it's essentially a way of destigmatizing. You're certain the person has an authentic individuality, they're a fully rounded human person with certain problems. So you're no longer a schizophrenic, you are a person with schizophrenia, or a person overcoming schizophrenia, or as you say these days, a survivor, somebody who's surviving schizophrenia. Now, how much does it have a real effect? People's own attitudes. Trouble is, a lot of studies on stigma are just about people's attitudes and the words used to actually describe the stigmatized individual. How is stigma actually enacted in everyday life? For that, of course, we need an ethnographic anthropological type study, and there are indeed very few of them in this area. So most of the studies are just questionnaire studies, asking what terms people use and so on. Not actually terribly helpful in identifying what may be actually going on when the person is in society. Now, there's evidence from recent psychiatry. The popular understanding of mental illness, and thus the social response to it, may actually determine the prognosis of the illness itself, quite independent of medical treatment. Indeed, it's generally accepted that schizophrenic illness in third world countries, perhaps paradoxically, has a much better response, has a much better prognosis than schizophrenia in Western societies. More doctors and social workers at hospitals and so on you have around the place, the worse patients seem to do. So, fewer poor outcome patients were found in the studies conducted by the World Health Organization, its famous study, the International Pilot Study in Schizophrenia, and the foreign one, which is called Determinants of Outcome Study. And that's been attributed to differences in the individual responsibility for the illness, and thus to different concepts of personal identity. The assumption that the value placed on the autonomous individual in an industrialized, largely Western culture, accentuates the social exclusion of a chronic psychiatric patient who assumes personal responsibility for the illness, which makes a worse prognosis. So to put it very briefly, when we're thinking about schizophrenia now,
There's another one
just on the right. The black one's even worse, I tried it before. The other one was so good.
The black one.
Oh, it's yellow. Clearly, it tends to be blue. It's yellow, I checked it earlier. Let's try it. Oh, thanks so much. Oh, it was great. Thanks. Okay, so it's Greek letter sigma for schizophrenia. Yes and no, there are two stages of schizophrenia. The first stage is fairly biological. This is data of the brain damage caused to schizophrenia. You have schizophrenia after you take crack or amphetamines. If twin boys or girls are born and one of them develops schizophrenia, is more likely to have had what we call minor insults to the brain in infancy. So the child that's born second is more likely than the first to have schizophrenia, presumably because they're anoxic in the point of delivery. Okay, and of course the genetic evidence, which is not conclusive, which suggests there's some genetic, hence biological tendency for schizophrenia. But the second stage, most of us would argue, is rather social. It depends a lot on what you make of the schizophrenia. And the American sociologist called Warner proposed that the course of schizophrenia is related to gender roles, to social class and social identity, and to labour dynamics. He argues that unemployment of the mentally ill in capitalist economies leads to a loss of self-esteem, loss of status and independence, whereas in developing countries, a mentally ill person may be excluded less because of graduated accommodation of work to presumed identity. Sorry, presumed ability. You said that by arguing two rather stereotyped examples. Develop psychosis in a Ghanaian village, but it still needs something to look after the goats. So maybe when you're wilder parents, they'll chain you up in the centre of the marketplace, as they do in Ghana, where local kids may throw stones at you and so on. But the rest of the time, when you're not overtly disturbing, you'll be looking after the goats, you have a valued social role. That's one end of my exaggerated spectrum. The other end will be, how would you feel about somebody who's having schizophrenic hallucinations operating the buttons in the new Fair Power Station. That's, of course, an extreme example, just at the other side. So maybe something like that going on. In small-scale, less industrialized societies, there's a more graduated acceptance of the patient and who performs more of a better social role. It might be that being in a log, chained to a log in a garden end village actually makes you better in terms of mental health prognosis and being looked after in a psychiatric hospital, with our emphasis on psychology, which probably doesn't help schizophrenia at all, or emphasis on personal responsibility and all the rest of it. It's quite common even for me to be stigmatizing with some of my patients. So I haven't seen the patient for 3 months. They turn up and they're really quite seriously ill. I said, why didn't you go and see the community nurse for your injection? Why didn't you attend occupational therapy? Why didn't you go to family therapy? And all the other things which we go on, art workshops and so on. Person says they couldn't be bothered, but they're having these awful experiences now. I'm likely, I think, to be slightly disparaging of their behaviour and tell them, well, this is probably your own fault you'd be coming again. If you'd had the injection 2 weeks ago, you might actually be well now. So since then, I'm loading that patient with responsibilities which, given the nature of schizophrenia, are probably rather unfair. And I'm placing a lot of responsibility on their own individual agency, which of course is the thing that's actually affected in schizophrenia. And probably contrary to your wishes and certainly to mine, psychotherapy is only effective for schizophrenia. We wonder if it could be, but the theories of R.D. Lang and David Cooper are now largely generally discredited. Formal psychotherapy does not help schizophrenia at all. Possibly by psychologizing it, it actually makes it worse. We assume it's more humane to psychologize issues, but it might work in the opposite direction. And maybe a supernatural explanation is actually less harming for the patient. So if I say to the patient, well, I'm sorry you'll be coming against that evil spirit bothering you, I'll try to exorcise the spirit out of you, or we'll go for a healing ceremony together and we'll chuck the spirit out of you and you return to normal, that actually may be less stigmatizing than our emphasis on psychology and you can actually do it. When, because of the nature of the illness, you can't actually do that. Some evidence that nuclear and thus Western families are less accepting of mental illness than extended families. WHO psychiatrist Nico Sartorius assumes that in non-industrialized societies, the environment for schizophrenia is, I'm quoting him here, supportive and tolerant, with little risk of prolonged rejection, isolation, segregation, and institutionalization. So again, this is counterintuitive here. Counterintuitive argument. The first one was really the more developed the mental health services, the worse people do. And the second counterintuitive thing is the more we psychologize, the more we try to understand that person, the more we dig around in their brain and help them overcome the issues themselves, that also is no good for them. Now, there's a theoretical problem here faced by sociologists and cultural psychiatrists as to actually what a disease model of psychiatric illness is. Do we assume there's an existing disease quite independently of social things going on? I've been arguing for the first part of my schizophrenia here, the biology disease going on in your brain, and nothing we can do about that. Or do we assume a more deviancy theory-orientated model, which minor deviances responded to by families and by societies by increasing the rejection of the patient so they develop further behaviour which actually ends up as schizophrenia. So deviancy theorists have largely argued that schizophrenia is just a response to social exclusion. But I should point out that deviancy theorists are generally out of fashion. There's certain social class differences with deviancy in the West. Let's talk a bit about them. Two sort of general models. I call it very crudely the NW3 model, or the Hampstead Mall or NW Theatre Postal area in London, which includes the psychoanalyst where every second person is in therapy, along with the working class mall, what you call it, called the EAD Mall. It's been demonstrated by questionnaires. So in both societies, imagine sort of a graph of increased demons, whatever we mean by demons. And in the NW3 model, you assume that all people have psychological difficulties anyway, because we're all in the therapy, we've all got problems. So you're much more tolerant of demons all the way along the line. So you really need a very strong level of demons of antisocial or asocial behaviour to actually achieve a label of mentors and be stigmatised. In the AIDS community, it appears that people are much more sympathetic and tolerant of minor demons. So below this line here, it's not zero, the pretend graph. So in Hampstead, you're saying already at this point, don't you think you ought to see a therapist for dealing with your bad temper or your shiny pound or ideas and so on. Working class people have been shown to be much more tolerant at low levels of demons. But as the demons rises, you get a sudden point at which demons is no longer accepted at all. In NW3, if you're schizophrenic, you're still saying the same thing, why don't you have some therapy, why don't you see a psychotherapist, I'm sure there's something we can do. But working class population reject you as you go over the line of extreme demons, normally involving violence to us, or total unintelligibility, or whatever. So we have a biphasic pattern in the E8, and a sort of more graduated pattern in NW3. A couple of them are rather confused. Is that clear? Shall I go over it again? Again? Okay. The problem with certain stigmatisation, we normally do it by questionnaire, and that's indeed what I've done myself. But the point is, well, how on earth do we design the questionnaire and do we actually measure the same sort of thing? Stigmatisation, of course, is the objective sociological view of the process that's actually going on, so we can't actually use that. What I've done in my questionnaire is avoid all medical words altogether and simply describe a person's problems and then ask the respondent's response to those particular problems. But key thing is, are psychiatric illnesses generally recognised anywhere around the world? Consensus is that something like chronic schizophrenia is generally recognised as a discrete and undesirable state, usually, but not always, aligned to some sort of physical illness. If somebody's totally crazy, you might not say this is an illness at all, but you'd recognise it as a deviant state. Characterised primarily by continued unintelligibility, although the local perspective on where they often emphasise violence or nudity or some other antisocial characteristic. In both Trinidad and Boston in the US, relatives respond particularly to altered appearance and inexplicable actions, and they rate these as the most disturbing changes. But the minor things, minors are a term used in psychiatry, mean less serious psychiatric conditions than schizophrenia. So we'd include things like acute psychosis, where the person recovers totally, maybe mental handicap, abnormal personality, or just neurotic problems, anxieties, fears and phobias. And this can be understood in quite a number of different ways in different societies, as actual moral choices, as it were for my community in Trinidad and similarly in Albania, as antisocial behaviour, or as physical or psychological illnesses, or just as simple points on a spectrum of possible everyday action and experience. Looking at historical data, other people propose that popular and professional categorisations alike are focused on wider changes in notions of moral order. The studies comparing different European societies, the study was England, France, Germany, I think America. People also, what is the popular perception of somebody's mental illness? But put it in lay terms, what's the professional medical perception of mental illness? We assume that given the internationality of biomedicine, the professionals would all agree between themselves, and possibly the lay views would have been rather different. But in fact, one of the studies done by Charles Townsend showed was there's a close fit between the popular perception of mental illness in any one community and the professional perception, and that statistically outweighs any commonality among the professionals. Okay, in some East African communities studied a few years ago, a naturalistic explanation of yours went along with an alter human or personalistic one. It's probably a bit of jargon there. Are you happy to disagree naturalistic and personalistic? Naturalistic means the same methods as natural science, deals with cause-effect relationships, independent of human awareness, happening out there in the natural world. Stuff of natural science, in other words. Personalistic explanation is one which involves such things as identity, memory, individual personality, agency, action, choice, and so on. And of course, social anthropology inevitably has to deal with the fit between the two. So when we rely too much on one way, then people complain. If we do too much the other way, then other people complain. So the moment of evolution in psychology, which proposes a naturalistic explanation of things that are otherwise considered personalistic, is very much criticised by social anthropologists. Okay, we're getting back to East Africa. Naturalist explanation of serious mental illness and the psychosis they recognised. In fact, naturalist explanation is something like a worm in the brain, whatever we think of that in biomedical terms, at least it's a naturalistic explanation. But I saw the explanation went with a poor prognosis, but an old personalistic explanation, supernatural explanation, ultra human if you like, went with expectations of a better prognosis. So as if you assume that when you've got a natural science explanation of something, things are much worse, and if you have a more personalistic or supernatural explanation, then things do a lot better. Presumably because the supernatural explanation, you can evoke something like exorcism or some other way of dealing with the magic, and hence things can get better. Once you've got a worm in your brain, then you're really sunk. However, in Britain and Hawaii, the same study was done, and found the reverse things. So in Britain and Hawaii, both argue more Western societies than Tanzania and Kenya, where the East African study was done, then if you had the naturalistic explanation of the illness, then it favoured a better prognosis, and anything personalistic made for a worse prognosis. In the robot swarm, a madness is more likely to be seen as caused by sorcery than is epilepsy. It's less likely to be seen as contagious, and hence presumably less likely to be seen as physical or natural, whatever you can call that end of things. And yet, paradoxically, Western biomedical treatment is more likely to be sought for schizophrenia than for epilepsy. So whatever the explanation of the illness, treatment doesn't necessarily for its use, as you might imagine. Normally, we tend to assume that the treatment is the reverse of the cause. You know what's caused the illness, then you reverse the treatment, and people get better on sort of stress time model. But not actually so. You can have a natural explanation, which argues for a better prognosis in some societies or worse prognosis in others. What people actually say they know or they do know doesn't mean that people actually follow that in particular situations. This is a big problem of weakened stigmatization. So in certain countries like India, China, Ireland, there's an idea of a mental handicap, you're chosen by God, you're a sort of sensory person, you're sort of God's fool in some sort of way. Does that make for a better prognosis or for less stigmatization and where you don't have that? I also that there's a Buddhist sect of monks, Shmu monks, who are supposed to be mad. They're called in Tibetan mad monks. So I went up to Tawang, which is east of Bhutan, just near the Tibetan border. I stayed in a Tibetan monastery. I interviewed the monks there to see if they were any more accepting of mentors. I couldn't find any Shmu monks anywhere, so I made do with a normal Tibetan Buddhist monastery. But I tried to find out, are these monks actually more sympathetic to mentors? Using my questionnaire, which has a description of somebody who behaves rather abnormally, but not using words like schizophrenia or indeed mentors at all. I found on the whole the monks were not particularly more sympathetic than other people. At Converse, I found the opposite thing in Trinidad, just to make things even more complicated. In Trinidad, in the West Indies, mentors, when you talk to people, is highly stigmatized. I asked my villagers, what happens when somebody goes mad in our village? And they'd say, oh, that's terrible. They're violent, they're dangerous, they'll burn the house down. You'll call somebody. We immediately call the police, have them take them to St. Anne's Hospital in Port of Spain, a psychiatric hospital, and we hope the doctors will never let them go. There's a common West Indian expression, which is once mad, always mad. So if you're diagnosed as being mentally ill, then there's no possible recovery from that. So highly stigmatized in theory. Whilst I was in the village, few people actually just charged became psychotic over those 18 months. And I found that in practice, people actually bent over backwards not to see the person as actually mentally ill. So it's actually less stigmatization than we might have assumed from the pure abstract theoretical proposition of once mad, always mad. So we have to be very careful what terms we actually use. So concepts similar to the English word insanity, such as pagol in Bengali or pisu in Sinhalese, might also have some notion of eccentric but meaningful value. In other words, we might be using the word mad in a sort of rather weak sense, in the same way in which you tell me the day before your final exam you went out and got totally drunk. And I say to you, you must have been crazy to do that. Your whole future's ruined. Okay? Now, I'm using the word crazy to mean grossly inappropriate behavior. I'm not using that, of course, to mean actually psychotic. So we have to be careful as to whether the terms people are actually using might actually refer to that. So, I mean, when I say you must be mad to do this, I'm not actually suggesting you're mentally. I'll finish by talking a bit about our stigmatization questionnaire. And normally anthropologists, of course, don't use questionnaires, but I'm interested in some cursory overall data we might have got some clues from. Starting point of this was that when I first got interested in intercultural psychiatry in the 70s and 80s, it was commonly said that ethnic minorities in Britain stigmatized mentors more than others. Because they stigmatize it, they hide the mentally ill person away, and so they seek treatment later, the treatment's actually less effective, therefore black people go mad, it's really the fault of their own culture for stigmatizing them. And a lot of Indian psychiatrists in Britain, some of whom are my colleagues, and also describe the syndrome of the sort of mad woman in the attic. Feminist term which comes obviously derived from Jane Eyre. So the idea that the person is actually mad, you rot them away in the attic, you hope nobody notices them, because you're just trying to get your daughters off married, and then you're going to be married to the daughters of somebody who's mad. So they assure me the Indian culture grossly stigmatizes mentally and conceals lots of your mad granny up in the attic. What we found using the questionnaire was actually in our first Indian sample was done in Calcutta slums, translated the questionnaire, of course, into Bengali and back translated for some approximate equivalence. We actually found that Indians were less likely to stigmatize mentors, at least in the slum areas, than Indians, than we'd assumed. So stigmatization questionnaire, it starts with a brief description of somebody who behaves in a grossly inappropriate way sees things when there's nobody there, talks things nobody quite understands, loses a job, wanders around the neighbourhood insulting people, hits his father on one occasion, eventually the family take him into hospital, he's given medical treatment, which has some effect on him, but still a rather odd person when he comes out. All which I describe in lay terms, not using any medical jargon, not using words like madness or psychosis at all. We divide the questionnaire in 3 separate languages, in Bengali, Sinhalese and English, all at the same time, so as not to give primacy to the English. Problem with using cross-cultural questionnaires in psychologists, then they always start from English and translate it into another language, and then achieving some sort of approximation of meaning when you back-translate it. It's seen by the psychologist as a guarantee of its objectivity, which of course it's not. Here's a bit of me as an anthropologist says you really can't do that, you have to develop it within a particular culture. What cross-cultural psychology needs is questionnaires derived in New Guinea, Amazonia, India, and so on, translated then into English to see if there's any approximation of meaning. Because of the difficulties of doing studies like that, nobody's ever done that. Although a couple of my Indian students did a study on local English concepts and mentors and try to match them against the knowledge they had of Indian texts like the Sushruta, a classical medical text. So anyway, the description in the questionnaire of somebody who behaves in a way which a psychiatrist reading the questionnaire would say this person's probably got schizophrenia, but we're not asking that of the population we sample. We follow the vignette with questions like, would you be happy if your child's teacher was like this? Would you be happy if your sister married somebody who had this particular problem? Would you be prepared to work with this person? Would you eat food cooked by this person? So the food question was one of the questions that came from our Indian centre, where I wouldn't have thought of asking that in English, but we could in the English version, because the questionnaire is a performance of approximately the same questions all over the place. But some of the ideas come from non-European cultures. Okay, what did we find? On the whole, the statistician I worked with wanted to convert the whole thing into a psychometric instrument, contrary to my wishes. I just wanted a questionnaire with 20, and the 20 questions in it, of separate actually questions and answers. So he turned it into a psychometric instrument, using primary status data. So it's the name of statistical test, which enables you to do this, which I've now totally forgotten. Oh, Cronbach alpha and so on, and the rubbish like that. So these devices are the need test, which you then use to gain in analysis of our results. We use the same questionnaire in different language versions in India, Sri Lanka, England in different populations, France, Spain, Italy translated in the Caribbean and so on. So what those results actually show, that there's surprisingly little difference between the responses in these different countries. The final interpretation of course depends on whether the questionnaire actually means the same thing in different cultures. I might suggest by the medical part of my personality, so I've designed the questionnaire, whilst the anthropologist bit of me says, throw the rubbish, and so on. Anyway, any comparative attempt inevitably singles out those things which are translatable or transferable across cultures. And so we'll emphasise the apparently universal over the diverse. To generalise about cross-cultural differences in stigmatisation seems premature at the moment, given our paucity of knowledge. So I'm ending on a rather inconclusive note. Thanks.
Before we have a Yeah, thank you very much. It's really, really interesting. I just wanted to ask, well, there's a couple of things, but you were also talking about the kind of terminology issue and the issue of whether kind of changing labels for these kind of phenomena mean much, or whether sort of the political correctness dimension could be a bit kind of vacuous. And it made me think of the time when I used to work as a teaching assistant in a primary school, which was in the borough, one of the schools designated for special education needs kids. So not schizophrenia, but autism, variety, I think. And, you know, there the kind of, the change in terminology was also linked to a change in policy, because the attempt to kind of treat these things as special education needs, rather than, I mean, the attempt to treat it as kind of, you're talking about the difference between schizophrenia as an adjective and schizophrenia as a noun, you know, he's a schizophrenic versus using it as an adjective. And I mean, in some ways, while that might seem kind of empty and vacuous, doesn't that, in a way, reflect a sort of anthropological emphasis on process rather than structure, and sort of seeing these things as dynamic and shifting? And I mean, in the case of this school, the school where to work, it was linked to this policy of inclusion and this attempt to find ways of educating kids along with the other kids. So I don't know if you had any thoughts. Well, A, I think you think what we thought about that kind of policy of inclusion, and secondly, whether the link between terminology and policy and practice is not necessarily so vacuous. I don't know.
Well, empathetically, I've been trying to agree, but do we have the data for that? We see, I think, on the whole, rather less stigmatized attitude to deviance in a general sense now than we would have, say, 50 years ago. But is that to say through the change in terminology? Or just a general greater humanitarian empathetic approach? I mean, you really need to dig it out and see what's actually going on, to link the two. Which, of course, is a very complicated subject in terms of doing a social policy type study. But I mean, my PhD student of mine just finished the work in Ghana, terminating middle Ghana. They do chain the mentally ill people up, but they have a quite good prognosis, because when they're not so disturbed, they're allowed to look after the goats and so on. So we need more studies like that, which argue that maybe what seems to be stigmatization. I mean, this guy's chained up in the middle of the village, local kids are throwing stones at him, saying, madman, madman, talking nonsense. And you're really having a very awful time. But they do better being locked up with psychotherapy and all the rest of it in a Western psychiatric hospital. Is that actually because of the social response? Or is there something different going on in the brain? It's the difference of local indigenous psychology. So schizophrenia, whatever schizophrenia is, operates differently depending on your particular local conceptions. And we still don't have enough data to really answer that. But then pathetically, I hope that by changing the language, by saying a person with schizophrenia, it would help them actually do better than saying a schizophrenic. But I'm not sure.
Isn't the point that, I mean, what changes attitudes is not terms, but practices? So, for example, in the school where I worked, there was no stigmatisation of autistic kids at all, because the kids who had been in the school, who'd grown up in the age of four, being educated alongside them, did not have the attitude that I would have had at that age, or other people I was educated with at that age, because I wasn't exposed to it. So the policy of inclusion changed their attitudes. But the terminological change, it wasn't that changing the words transformed people's attitudes, but it seems to me that kind of representational change, as it were,
sort of went along with it.
It was necessary for a shift in attitudes to perpetuate shift in that. I mean, it goes back to the example of the use of the word nigger. I mean, it's obviously the classic example is the oppressed subculture is able to reappropriate the term. But the mainstream and necessary obliged to stop using the term in order to move forward politically. I mean, it seems to me that's demonstrated. So, I mean, it's not political correctness, it's not as kind of facile as all that, it seems to me.
I'm sure you may be right, but how does... So I'm all in favour of political correctness, but does it actually make for such a big difference, or would you need somewhere else at the same time? A bit wider change in the terminology can be a fairly token thing to do. We no longer call them Mongols or people with Down syndrome by those terms and say a person who has Down syndrome. Does that actually follow? Nice to think it did. I hope it does. I think it sometimes does. But we need to look at that more.
I think that anti-stigma campaigns are very valuable when they reduce that type of like social exclusion that you were referring to before. You know, people not being able to get jobs because of discrimination about mental illness and things like that. But I also wonder whether a focus on stigma kind of shifts attention from the way that some types of psychiatric categories can be kind of denigrated in themselves. And schizophrenia, I think, is one example. Someone called Melba Wilson, who's written about schizophrenia as having an origin in kind of administration and as being a kind of expression of fears of the uprisings amongst colonised populations. And while that's kind of a long time ago, there's still evidence about overdiagnosis of schizophrenia amongst the black population in the UK, in contrast to an overdiagnosis of depression amongst the white population. And I just wondered kind of what your thoughts are on that kind of tension between the psychiatric categories themselves and this kind of humanitarian anti-stigma
Right, well, it's not just a problem. Manic depressive illness is the best example. So I almost totally changed to bipolar illness as actually less stigmatized. Schizophrenia doesn't need to change to do anything else. The Hearing Network, Hearing Voices Network group, argue for a different approach, but they still maintain the word schizophrenia. Well, the problem, any term used in medicine which offers some disc, any illness category which is chronic, can become stigmatizing. If we stop using the term, then the comparative studies then become impossible, and we can't actually sort the population out to look at possible causes. That's if you assume that there is something going on with schizophrenia, and it's not purely a response to minor deviance. On the West Indian mental health question, which is the thing that really got me involved in cultural psychiatry and anthropology, slightly shifted my position. I used to think psychiatry was disgustingly racist, and certainly from looking at its history, and that overdiagnosis of West Indians was very common, particularly the time when we've seen the first West Indian immigrants who came from what were essentially peasant communities in countries like Dominica, and Jamaica. Not the same as the price, of course, the black British born, who are a totally different population. But you see, just by we could reduce overdiagnosis, just by tightening up on the way psychiatrists diagnose things, and if psychiatrists had a bit of anthropology and could understand and speak to God or hearing voices, it's not necessarily pathological, it can be culturally acceptable, that might reduce the incidence to some extent. So our big hope was educating psychiatrists might reduce it. But the dreadful news is that's not true. And black British-born children and grandchildren of West Indian migrants themselves have even higher rates of schizophrenia than the parental generation. So we have to throw something else into the equation, which I've always been interested in, maybe gave it less weight at the beginning, which is the issue of social racism and trying to affirm your identity in the language which is not truly your own. And evidence of that will be that communities around the world have high rates of schizophrenia. Let's just take them, although they have various similarities. Black Americans, Native Americans in Canada, French-speaking Canadians, Croatians on the Dalmatian coast, who I don't quite understand being in that population, but still. Australian Aboriginals, Maori in New Zealand, and the so-called coloured population in South Africa. All those have some features in common. a minority community, but not one so distinct away from the dominant culture. They're partially assimilated and using the cultures dominated and oppressed them to affirm their own identity. And maybe there's something fairly intangible in all of that, which actually argues for it. Of course, there's plenty of evidence that the mental health acts by which in Britain we can compel people to scream to use much more often in the favour of black people. About 6 months ago, I went to do an assessment of a murderer who was held in Broadmoor. I visited him on his ward, and everybody in the ward was black. I said, "Good heavens, you don't still have segregation in Broadmoor, do you?" And I said, "No, but show me some of the basic figures," which is a gross overrepresentation of black people in the security hostels. I mean, there are black people twice as likely to be involuntary patients in normal psychiatric hostels under the General Mental Health Act. A study I did about 20 years ago showed that black patients got higher doses of drugs, more likely to be given electroconvulsive therapy, even with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. ECT is normally not used for schizophrenia, it's used for depression. Just as I've done in Hackney, where highest proportion of people with ECT were East End Jews, which was very acceptable because they were depressed, and ECT is accepted treatment for depression. But closely following behind them were black Britons, resident in Hackney, who had other diagnoses, generally schizophrenia. And there's little evidence that ECT is the obvious treatment for most types of schizophrenia. So I generally I'd agree with that. Yeah.
I'm just wondering what you think, how useful you think medicalisation of certain forms of aberrant behaviour is, basically, because I certainly think I've obviously got incredibly partial experience, but I seem to think that in certain cases, individuals getting into the head that they belong to a specific category with a named condition can cause an extent. Cause the situation to deteriorate somewhat because they, rather than just thinking of their past, that it's a quirk of their personality, if you like, they think that it's indicative of something larger than biological basis. I was wondering what, how you react to that sort of idea.
Well, again, it's an empathetic statement. It's actually little evidence because nobody's done the study. It might be true that actually having a label means for worse prognosis. Just to give you an example from my own family, my wife's brother is a bipolar, he's manic depressive, but it hasn't affected him in psoriasis. He used to get psychotic at times, bizarrely behaved, ended up on section in the hospital, but was maintained his job as a librarian in between the two. And now the attacks seem to have stopped, hasn't affected him in any way at all, as far as I can see. And it's actually shown that having a label of schizophrenia means the diagnosis is worse. I suspect it might do. I'd argue earlier on that on the whole, psychiatry is actually bad for mental illness, and if the prognosis is better in the third world. Then you can't romanticise that to the idea of saying that all shame is really schizophrenics who escape being treated by psychiatrists and they perform a normal, decent social role and so on. Actually, most shamans, of course, are not schizophrenic and don't even have symptoms like that. But it's a rather romantic assumption that take away technology, take away psychiatrists, and all will be well. Certainly didn't happen in China during the Cultural Revolution, when all mental illnesses were labeled as a problem of class conflict and was sought out by trade union officials in the workplace. Psychiatrists were all packed off to work on pig farms, which is felt to be more appropriate for them. But there's no diminution in mental illness, as far as we know. But statistics are not very good.
Stigmatization. So to what extent policies which are in fact aimed at certain otherwise potentially stigmatized or disadvantaged groups of people can contribute to that stigmatization. So I'm thinking, you know, in terms of quotas for jobs for, you know, either women or disabled people, or since there are various policies for such for jobs or university degrees, etc. I was wondering whether you thought that potentially
positive discrimination. The only successful result, and I think, is what's done in Austria with the Guggen Project, who label all psychotics as artists. So this got all held up in a psychiatric hospital, which is really a giant art studio, and they paint the whole thing. And the paintings are sold by a very cheeky art gallery in central Vienna. And that seems to have been actually quite effective. What happens to a psychiatric patient who doesn't want to paint? So, I mean, this doesn't solve everything. What other sort of positive discrimination could you think of? Would you want schizophrenics preferentially to be your school teachers or your doctors? I mean, most people would object to that. Artists seems a bit safer.
I was interested in the bifurcation between the NW3 and the E8 sort of postal code models. How old is that bifurcation? Because I would imagine maybe that if you went back to before the middle of the 19th century, maybe that everyone might have subscribed to an E8 kind of model. Mm. And at some point towards the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, this seems to emerge. I mean, is that true? And then also, are there other kinds of bifurcation that occur in other societies that you've studied?
Oh, first point, nobody in the 19th century would have thought of doing the study. So we haven't the faintest idea. But the assumption is because of Freud and psychotherapy, turned to Hampstead, Tavistock Clinic, and all the rest of it. That's actually so. But maybe E8 has now got Hampsteadized. A better comparison, maybe Glasgow or Liverpool, I don't know. What the second point was?
Whether or not similar kinds of bifurcation.
Oh, right, yeah. But what normally done is industrial labour. It's factory labour accentuate or reduce stigmatisation. And we're getting content results here. We're studying India. We've done studies comparing rural Bengal with inner city slum Calcutta and with middle class areas of Calcutta. Also, I've studied in Chennai, Mumbai, and up in Assam. We assume that industrialization made for a worse prognosis. On the basis you have competitive individualism. So you're competing for the same factory jobs. So you have to totally distance yourself from individualism at all. Madness in my family? No, give me a job. We're all clean, we're all healthy people. Mentors, so they deny it. So there's an assumption that industrialization and factory labor made for greater stigmatization. Somewhat to our surprise, we haven't found that. But then it's just a limited sample in one population. I'd hate to generalize internationally from just comparing two bits of Calcutta.
Hi, I just wanted to ask another question, not so much about the question I have, but about kind of your ethnographic experience, because I guess it seems unusually for an anthropologist, you've had the chance to study in quite a lot of different locations. And I just wondered how you thought that affected your kind of analyses you produced, the kind of analytical process, because that's something not a lot of anthropologists really, they might have two sites, but not kind of multiple sites to compare. How do you think that's affected your take on things?
Well, the whole problem of comparative method in anthropology. And Pritchard famously said, if anthropology is anything, it's a comparative discipline, and that's impossible. I mean, the whole time we're trying to compare, we're realizing the gross limitations of actually comparing. I mean, there are a couple of places in which I compare the rather different communities of Trinidad and Albania in terms of historical memory and in terms of perception of mental illness, sort of agency in psychopathology. But there's so many variables going on, I'm just rather unhappy with doing that. So in each country has rather studying different things. In the Lebanon, I was looking at the Druze beliefs in the reincarnation. In Calabria and Italy, I was looking at the reasons for stigmatization at Easter time. In Albania, I'm just in a general sort of study on attitudes to illness and post-communism. Seeing that I was trying to do everything, they ended up with a sort of cult, an anti-white, back-to-nature Africanizing cult. And in Haiti, I studied voodoo and zombies. So really quite different things. But obviously, they're specific to a particular culture. Got zombies in Haiti. You don't have zombies in Albania. Maybe there's zombies in the Cameroons. Are there zombies in the Cameroons? Eddie Nautner said there was. Yeah, they're called zombies in Cameroon, as Edwin said.
Okay.
It's just the same. You kill somebody by sorcery, then bring them back to life, and they work on your garden for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And Sherry Gardner says they still exist now.
Yeah, well, I think it's insurance.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the two feed into each other. I did medicine first, and I got into the minorities mental, and then I went off to anthropology. But certainly, there obviously, immediate advantages. I trained as a psychoanalytical psychotherapist, so that meant I didn't write notes when doing the interview. So I could talk, I learned to talk to somebody for an hour, and then take 5 minutes to write up the notes, which is great for field work. So no tape recorders, no notebooks, nothing like that at all. The question was whether I accurately recorded the data or whether I fantasized, but who knows. But obviously, the two disciplines feed a lot into it. Well, the time of your Torres Straits expedition, which is the start really of both the disciplines, cultural psychiatry and social anthropology, when was it, 1893? Haddon and Rivers and Seligman. It's your founding charter, you should tell me. We had a conference 5 years ago. Right. Well, at that time, there's no difference between psychology and anthropology. So Rivers started off as a doctor, he went to my medical school, St. Bartholomew's, and he studied under Wundt in psychology in Germany, and then got on, came to Cambridge, gave lectures in experimental psychology, ended up on the Torres Straits. We did measure things like visual perception and so on, and suddenly invented the genealogical method and got into social anthropology. Then went off to study the Todas and so on. But then later came back to psychiatry during the First World War. He's one of my great heroes, failed hero.
Does your experience in anthropologists and the insights that you've had of kind of you use the word culture quite a lot, sort of gender cultural difference. Do you feel a tension between that and the kind of psychoanalytical ideas that you received in education, which are both kind of the subconscious as a universal feature? Or do you feel that you have cultural experience to kind of confirm that?
No, I'm not keen on using psychoanalysis in anthropology particularly. I think it results in nugatory. psychoanalysis is just too Western, too individualized, and so on. The experiments done by French and German anthropologists who went to West Africa in the 30s and the 40s, where they took a local guy out of the village, put him on the couch, and did free associations and so on. I think the data is very silly. Now, I think psychoanalysis, say you can offer you an alternative view on things. Totem and Taboo, Freud's classic book in anthropology, is great fun, but no more than that. I don't think the Oedipus complex is universal, although I agree with Marinossi on that. So if you're going to become an anthropologist, don't become a psychoanalyst, which of course was common in America in the 40s, 50s and early 60s, when in some places you couldn't qualify an anthropology, this also had a psychoanalysis in so-called culture and personality school. People like Cardner and so on, Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict and so on. I think on the whole the results weren't very good. And then the whole culture and personality sort of dissolved itself into what we can call cognitive anthropology, which is a much more hard-nosed discipline. So no need for you to have a psychoanalysis. You save a lot of money.